this ball, and the whole idea of having to rotate something around twice to make it to return to the same state. So it turns out that there's a really simple thing that you can do, which is completely analogous to that. Okay, so we're imagining this as our spinning electron. Maybe it's spinning this way or whatever, and we're going to rotate it around through 360 degrees, and we're going to find that there's no way to untangle these strings. And then we're going to rotate it through 720 and find that, in fact, we can untangle these strings. Okay, so that's the game plan here. Okay, so how many believe that this is possible? Okay, otherwise I wouldn't be doing it, right? Okay, so here's the thing. So I'm looking at that string over there, and I'm going to rotate the ball around through 360. Okay, and these strings are going to twist up. Okay, so here we go. So that's halfway around, and that's full way around. That's 360. Okay, so these strings are now are twisted up there, and they're twisted up down there. Okay, and it's pretty easy to probably convince yourself that there's no way I can untwist these strings. But what's really bizarre is if I rotate it now around again through another 360, so there's 180, there's 360, it seems like I've twisted this guy up more. And well, in a way I have, but in a way I haven't. In a way I've untwisted it. Okay, so if I take this, can I ask you to just lower this down a little bit to about there? Okay, now Shehalia's not going to turn this in any way. Okay, and now there's fun going to turn that, so don't turn that in any way. And I'm not going to turn this thing in any way either. All I'm going to do is just grab these strings here, and I'm just going to play around with them a little bit. Okay, so I'm going to turn this, I'm going to pull this string like this, okay, and I'm going to pull, okay, I think I have that right. Okay, and I'm going to take this guy from down here. Uh-oh, am I getting mixed up here? Can you hold this thing like down here, like that? No, that's fine. Okay, so we'll do this, and then I take this guy, and I pull this guy. It's a bit tricky. I pull this guy over like this. Okay, there's been no rotation happen, but now, Feng, if you can lower this guy down again. Okay. And Shekeli, if you can, like, just raise this up. Look. Whoa! Isn't that freaky? Hey, thank you very much, you guys. That was great. Okay, it worked. Thank you. Okay, so I wonder if this table is okay to walk on all the way. Okay. Okay, so let's see here. So I have this, I have a demo here for you. And this demo is a okay, I'll just show you what it is. Okay, so let me just plug this guy in. It's called an electron diffraction device. Okay. Okay, so basically what this thing is I wonder if we can just turn off this screen here so it's really dark in here. But if we do that, how about we do this? Let me go to this thing. And that thing. Okay, so let's do that. And because I want it to be dark in the room here. Okay, so what you see here is this, it's a tube, right? And there's some white on the front. That white is painted on the inside, and it's phosphor. Okay. And in the back here, there's an electron gun. So a source of electrons, making a beam of electrons going from the back of the tube to the front of the tube, hitting this phosphor on the inside. What happens when an electron hits phosphor? It lights up. It glows. It's green. Okay. It glows green. And so this is basically. The principle behind the operation of an old television or a kind of an old computer monitor, the CRTs, you know, the big heavy ones, not the LCD things. The big heavy ones. There's an electron beam at the back, and the electron beam scans over a phosphor screen on the front, and it makes basically a moving dot, and then you modulate how bright that dot is, and you generate a picture, right? So that's your television screen. Okay, so what I claim here is that, so this is like a television screen, except that what's going to appear on there is far more amazing than anything you will ever see on television, or on your computer screen, or on your YouTube screen, or anything like that, okay? What's going to appear on there is truly bizarre, okay? So are we all ready to see what's going to appear on here? Okay, so I must say that I have a power supply here, and so I'm gonna turn this guy on, and so there's a low voltage, there's a low current passing through some little filament, which is making the electrons. But those electrons need to be accelerated. How do we accelerate an electron? How do we make it go faster? How do we change its speed? We put it in an electric field. An electric field, we can make an electric field by putting, say, putting a battery between two plates here and here. 0 volts and 10 volts, there's an electric field. It will cause the electron to accelerate. But instead of just like 10 volts or something, we have like 6,000 volts on here. Okay, so this is 6,000 volts, so don't come here and put your tongue on it or anything. Okay? So, okay, so. Okay, you guys, come on, settle down. No, none of you are going to come up here and do that. Okay, so. Right, so let me crank up the voltage. Well, let me turn this down a wee bit. Okay. Turn down the lights. I'm going to turn all the lights off. Okay. So here we go. Cranking up the voltage here. I think this is on. Okay. There we go. See that little green dot in the middle? Okay. So that's low voltage. We're only at like 500 volts. Okay. Now we're accelerating the electron to greater and greater speeds. More and more energy. We're up to 1,000 volts now. Okay. We're up to 1,500. Okay. And we're up to like 2,000 volts now. What do you see is happening? Okay. It's green. Yes, absolutely. Yeah, it's green. Okay. Okay, but it's not uniformly green, right? What do you notice about the shape of that greenness? There's a what? There's a node. So there's a point right in the center, right? And what else? There's rings of bright and dark. Okay, so it's basically the center point, and then two rings around it that are brighter than the rest. Okay, the fact that those two rings, those two brighter rings exist, as opposed to just being basically uniform brightness across the screen, is an exact demonstration of the fundamental mystery of quantum mechanics, which is superposition. These are actually matter waves or matter electrons behaving as waves right before your eyes. Okay, so this is the most amazing things you'll see ever on a phosphor screen. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what's going on inside that tube. Okay, so inside the tube, we've got what? So we've got this phosphor screen, so the green screen on the front there, okay? And we've got an electron beam here, a source of electrons. And we've also got between the source of electrons and the screen, we've got some atoms, okay? And I'm drawing the atoms in these little blue balls, okay? So the basic idea of how this thing works, this is sort of a simplification. It's a little bit more complicated than this, but this is sort of a simplification, is the electron gun emits electrons one by one, and these electrons come out sort of in random directions here, and they hit these atoms and bounce off of them or scatter off of them and then go toward the screen. And whenever an electron hits the screen, wherever it hits the screen, it makes a tiny green flash. Okay, so we see green solid on. That just means there's zillions of electrons going through there. Okay, but we're imagining that we're turning down the intensity of the beam, so we just got one electron at a time going through and making a little bright green spot. Okay, so here's one electron is emitted by the electron source. It hits this atom maybe over there and bounces off and hits the screen there, makes a little green flash. The next electron comes out. Maybe instead of hitting that atom, it hits that atom at some angle or whatever, and it bounces off, hits the screen there, and so on. Okay, so there's the third electron coming off, hitting the screen, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, so this is actually a fairly complicated thing to analyze. So instead of considering a whole bunch of atoms, the number of atoms here is actually a finite size target, okay, of atoms. And so there's maybe 10 to the 23 atoms. There's lots of atoms. So instead of considering 10 to the 23 atoms here, we will simplify. That's what physicists always do. They simplify, simplify, simplify until they can wrap their mind around it, and then they expand. Okay? So we're going to simplify to just one atom, okay, and try to make sense of what's going to happen. Okay, so let's see. So an electron is emitted by the electron gun, the source, and it hits the atom at some location and bounces off to the screen. Maybe the next electron comes out and hits the atom at a slightly different location, okay, or with a slightly different angle. Okay, and so it'll come flying off at some different angle, hit the screen at a different spot, okay? And maybe the third one comes out and it misses the atom entirely, okay? In fact, of course, you've got a single atom like that, okay, and you've got this beam that's this wide, okay, the chance you're going to hit the atom is pretty small. So most of them go just past, but anyways, we've got some more of them hitting the atom. And then the question basically is, what do we expect to see on the screen here? What kind of illumination do we expect to see? Equal. Okay, so we expect to see basically a uniform illumination. Okay, it's equally likely. So of all of the electrons that, so most of them bypass that atom, like this guy over here. But of those electrons that hit an atom and reflect off, the angle at which they hit is completely random, and we should get random hits. And if we build up those random hits over time, we're just going to see just a uniform green screen. Okay, that's what we expect to see. Okay, so no pattern of hits. Okay, so now let's bring in, instead of just one atom, let's make the situation a little bit more complicated. Let's bring in a second atom. Okay, so there's our second atom, and let's see what we can say about this. Okay, so there's one electron that comes out. Now maybe that electron hits that atom, atom number one, at some angle and bounces off and hits the screen over there. Okay, next electron comes out, and maybe it hits the second atom over there at some angle so that it bounces off that way. Okay. The third electron comes out, maybe it hits the first atom, random angle, bounces a random direction, hits the screen at a random point. So with two atoms here, okay, what do we expect to see? What kind of pattern do we expect to see? What's that? Still equal, right? I mean, so what? So if we've got one atom, we have this random scattering, and they hit the screen all over the place. If we have a second atom there, there's just more places to scatter off of. Okay? And so what we'd expect is just totally random. Okay? So that's what we expect to see. No particular pattern of hits, just a uniform greenness. Okay? But when we actually do an experiment of this type, okay, we find that there's a very specific pattern of hits. Okay? It's not just uniform. It's not just random like that. Okay? And the pattern of hits looks something like this. Okay, so there are spots on the screen where electrons do hit, that's the green blobs here, and there are definitely spots where the electrons do not hit. Okay, that's the pattern that you're seeing here. The bright green circle is a place where electrons hit. The red X is a place in between those two bright bands. Okay, that's dark. Okay, so there's a definite pattern of hits, and we're looking at that and thinking, well, how is that possible? What's going on here? Okay, so that's our question. How is this possible? So let's just go back. If we have, like, why this is so stunning is because if we have one atom there, there's no reason why any given electron can't hit that atom at the right angle so that it hits the screen at that point. Okay, if you're firing zillions of electrons through here, then the chances are one of those electrons is going to hit the atom exactly right so that it will hit that spot on the screen. Okay, there's no reason why an electron starting from here can't end up at that spot on the screen. Absolutely no reason. We all agree? Okay. Now we have a second atom, and we ask the same question. Okay, well, there's no reason why an electron can't go from there to there scattering off of that second electron. No reason whatsoever, right? There's no reason why electrons can't hit that spot. Okay. Now here's the really bizarre thing. Okay, when we put two of them now, two atoms side by side, everything changes dramatically. Okay, first electron over here, there's no reason why it can't do that. Okay, but it doesn't do that. Okay, so somehow with just one atom there, there's no reason why it can't hit that spot on the screen. Suddenly we bring in the second atom, and now suddenly we can't hit that spot on the screen anymore. Even though the electron is taking this path, hitting the first atom. So here's the difference. Let me see if I can reverse this. No, that's going to mess it up. Okay, so here's the idea. With this guy gone, there's no reason why the electron can't get from there to there. Okay? But suddenly with this guy present, it can no longer get there. How is it possible that taking this path here, this guy even knows about this second atom? If it's bouncing off of this one, how does it even feel the presence of that one? How does it even know that one exists? I mean, it's just crazy, right? Same and vice versa for the other one, right? With this guy not present, there's no reason why the electron can't go from there to there. And in fact, it does. Okay? We do see electrons hitting there when this other atom isn't present. We stick the second atom there, and somehow, although the electron is hitting the second atom, it somehow knows about the first one, the presence of the first one. That's like totally bizarre. Okay? So we can make sense of this by recognizing that the pattern of hits on the screen, light, dark, depends upon something very important. It depends upon the difference in path length between the electron hitting one atom and going to a point on the screen and the other. So what I mean is, so here is one point on the screen where an electron can hit, for example. The difference between this length of the electron hitting the first one and this length of the electron hitting the second one, there's a path difference, okay? And so if you consider that point on the screen, there's a certain path difference between those two paths. If you consider a second point on the screen, say, for example, that one, there's a path difference between the two red paths. And if you carefully calculate the path difference as you move along the screen, you'll find that the path difference varies. It changes. But it changes in a regular way. It changes in a way that directly corresponds to these bright, dark fringes. Okay? So what's being said here is that somehow, when an electron goes from here to here, it somehow knows about the path difference. It knows about the difference between that length of path and that length of path. And the only way it can know such a difference is if it is simultaneously in both paths. Okay? So that's what I mean about this thing being rather bizarre. It's showing you direct evidence right in front of your face that the electron is doing two things at once. Okay? So this is what we talked about a lot. In the everyday world, we have possibilities X or Y. In the quantum world, we have possibilities. We can replace or with and. Okay? So the electron can exist in both of these paths simultaneously, or more to the point, the electron can exist at these two points in space simultaneously. Okay? Or behave as if they are in that kind of weird, freaky state. Okay? All right. So either that or there's other interpretations. That's sort of inconsistent with the Copenhagen interpretation. There's also the many worlds interpretation. So I think some of you are with Ward Struve. Done some mentoring. Did you guys talk about different interpretations a little bit? You talked about Bohmian interpretation, right? And that. So there's a variety of different interpretations, and one of them is the many worlds. So in the many worlds, so either we're saying the electron is doing, two things at once in two places at once, or we're saying that the entire universe splits at this point, okay, into two universes, okay, one in which the electron takes this path and the other universe it takes the other path. Okay, and the fact that there is this freaky pattern on this screen here, those light and dark, right here, right inside this tube, is where two universes are overlapping. Okay, it has split. The electron leaves here, two universes are born, or the universe splits into two, and during the time that this weird interference is happening, those two universes are overlapping. Okay, that's what we're saying. Okay, like just crazy things like that are happening. Okay, or other interpretations. There's Bohmian interpretation, all that stuff. Okay, so now here's something that's going to totally blow your mind. Okay, so this is basically double slit. You all recognize this as the double slit experiment, right? In a different form, right? Okay, now I'm going to show you something which is often a question with a double slit. What happens if you look to find out which slit it's actually going through? And the answer is that the interference, what happens to the interference pattern? It disappears, okay? I want to show you a really dramatic example of that. Okay, so instead of considering two atoms here, let's go back to all the atoms. How many atoms are in here? Four. There's 10 to the 23. 10 to the 23 atoms physically. I only got, I'm showing, I can't draw 10 to the 23 atoms on my PowerPoint. Okay, so I got my 4 equals 10 to the 23 atoms on there. And here's the idea. Okay, so with the double slit, what we want to do is somehow observe which slit it's going through. The analog here is, let's try to ask which atom the electron scatters off of. Okay, so let me just reiterate here. So in getting from that point to that point on the screen, say, the idea is the electron simultaneously exists in all possible paths. Okay? And the idea is, well, okay, unless we are actually looking. Okay, if we're actually looking, then we find that, oh, in fact, no, it's not in all possible paths simultaneously. It's really only in one or the other or the other. Okay, so somehow if we were looking, so if when we're not looking, so our eyes are closed, then what we find is all possible paths. If we were to look, then we would find that it just reduces to one. It's really only going on one. How in this case can we look? Give me an example of how do you think we could look at that electron? How do you think we could determine after the fact which path the electron took? So we're releasing one electron at this end, and we're seeing one flash on the screen, and we're trying to determine after the fact which path the electron took. How do you think we could do that? Yeah.
Particles, and you can see where a photon came off, because a photon interacting, you know, gets off another photon.
Yeah, so that's the kind of thing that we're looking for. Okay, so the kind of thing we're looking for is the electron is scattering off of one of these atoms. Maybe it has an effect on that atom, or maybe it emits another particle or something. Okay, so that's the kind of thing we're looking for. Okay, and a particularly convenient physical mechanism to grab a hold of, to make use of here, is the idea of electron spin, which we just talked about. Okay, so here's the idea. What we do is we make, like, let me just show the picture here. So we consider the electron spin. So we're imagining the electron here as it flies through space here in sort of a classical way. We're thinking of it as a spinning top. Or let's say it's a billiard ball. So a billiard ball is coming in like this, the cue ball, and it's hitting one of these guys, which we'll think of as a billiard ball. So if I have a cue ball coming in, the white ball, and I hit it with my stick, so there's spin. Okay, so this thing is spinning, say this way, counterclockwise. When it hits this atom here, it might impart some spin or angular momentum to that atom. So you can see if you go counterclockwise, you know when you're shooting pool, if you spin it counterclockwise, it hits that ball, it'll make that ball rotate clockwise. So some of the angular momentum of this guy is or the rotational motion of this guy is transferred to that guy. So what does that mean? That means, okay, so how do we do this experiment? So what we do is we start out with all of the atoms not spinning. Okay? There's 10 to the 23 of them. Okay? We make sure they're all not spinning. And then we allow one electron to be released here and hit the screen somewhere over there. Okay? And then what we do is we go with a very, very large magnifying glass, and we look at every single one of those 10 to the 23 atoms inside this little sample of stuff there, and we determine which one ended up spinning, which one has a little bit of spin. Okay? And then we say, aha, this one is spinning. So we know out of all possible paths here, you know, bouncing off of any one of these guys, it actually bounced off this thing. Okay? Now, you can imagine that this is a rather like a needle in a haystack type of activity, right? Going in there and trying to find one out of 10 to the 23 atoms, which one ended up spinning. Okay? So in practice, it's impossible to do. But in principle, it is possible to do. And nature doesn't care about things whether they're hard to do or easy. The fact that it is possible to do in principle even means that it changes the interference pattern here dramatically. Okay? It changes the interference pattern from this, light, dark, light, dark, light, dark, these rings, to totally washed out. It totally washes out the interference pattern. Isn't that freaky? The fact that you could even in principle determine a change in the spin of one of those 10 to the 23 atoms means the interference pattern disappears. And you can do this experiment. And it actually works. Isn't that freaky? Whoa. OK. So blah, 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 blah. OK. Sorry?
He's asking Fong.
OK. Yeah.
Why we have a so bright green point? OK.
So the reason is, so the bright green green in the center has to do with the difference between the picture I've presented for you and the reality. So the reality is it looks more like this inside that tube. Hockey stick disaster. Hockey stick disaster number two. Disaster number three. Okay. All right. So inside the tube, we have these electrons coming out like this. And what we've got is actually a bunch of atoms like this. And then this, the green screen is over here. Okay. And it's not just one row of atoms like this. Like you can imagine, this is like multiple slits. It's like a barrier with a bunch of slits like this. Okay. And so it could pass through these slits. But in fact, it's a whole bunch of atoms. Of course, there's 10 to the 23 of them, and it's a crystal. So it's an entire crystal like this. And then there are certain directions in which you get constructive interference and certain directions where you get destructive interference, if you were to say, for example, send waves through. But the idea is particles behave like waves. Okay, so there's a big bright dot in the center because the zeroth order thing that could happen is, like the simplest thing that could happen is just the waves or the electrons just pass straight through. Okay, and so basically that's the width of the electron beam, is that central bright spot. Okay, but then there are certain directions from each of these atoms, so the electron could hit this. So in getting to that point on the screen, the electron could hit that electron, hit that atom and bounce off, or that one and bounce off, and so on. And if you add up all those possible paths, you find there are certain directions in which you get interference. Okay, and those directions then form a ring like that. And then in that direction, it's that frame. The next year. So that's what's actually happening. All right. Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about, how much time do we have? Okay. Let me tell you a little bit about entanglement. So we've heard stuff about entanglement, right? Especially at the IQC, we heard a little bit about entanglement. And what I'd like to do is make this concept of entanglement, which is very, very bizarre, a little bit clearer. Okay, I'm going to try to do that. And the way I want to do that is understand that entanglement is nothing but superposition again. The central mystery of quantum mechanics is superposition. When you have one particle in multiple states, you get stuff like this. When you have these interference patterns, when you have two particles, two or more particles, that can exist in multiple states simultaneously, then you get weird stuff like entanglement. Okay, so let me talk a little bit about that. Okay. So what we got here, so this is quantum entanglement 101. Okay, so this is just a couple of slides here. So what I have is a magic dragon here, who is, I have to crap, it's not a very, very good image of a dragon, but anyways, this is what I can find on the internet, okay? So it's a magic dragon who is flipping a coin here, okay? And there's something interesting about this coin that he's flipping. All right, so we got our magic dragon up there, and this is what he does. He flips a coin like this. He flips it up like this, and he catches the coin, but he doesn't look at it. So he catches it like this. He doesn't know what it is. He catches the coin, and then he this is the coin here, and he cuts the coin this way without looking at it. So he splits it into the two faces, okay, which may be heads, tails, or tails, heads. Okay? So he flips the coin, cuts it in two, and gives one face of the coin. He puts it in a box. Gives it to Alex. And the other one is placed in a sealed box, and Bob. Okay. And Alice goes off to Mars, and Bob stays here on the Earth, or whatever. They separate themselves with a vast distance. Neither of them knows what is inside the box, nor does the dragon. No one knows what's inside these boxes. Okay, and then they separate to this vast distance, and then we allow them to look what's inside their boxes. Okay, so Alice opens up her little package here, her box, looks inside, and sees, oh, I have a heads face of this. So if Bob opens his box, what's he going to see? Okay, so obviously he's going to see tails. Okay, so that's one possibility. And the other possibility, of course, is the other one where Alice sees a tail and Bob sees a head. Okay, so there are two possibilities. Okay, there's heads, tails, or tails, heads. Okay? Those are the only two possibilities. Okay? That's in the classical universe of Newton. Okay, what about the real universe? What about the quantum universe? What can I do with that or? I can make that or into an and. Okay, now here's where the freaky stuff happens. This is where entanglement happens. Okay, so if I make that an and, what does that mean? Okay, when it was an or, it's clear that what was in Alice's box was either a head or a tail. Okay, and it was a definite state. If I make this an and, then somehow nature is in a superposition of doing this and this at the same time. So if we look at Alice's box all by itself, what's inside is neither definitely a head's face nor definitely a tail's face. What's inside her box is something totally indefinite, right? There's something that's not in a definite state, okay? And similarly for Bob, okay? So we indicate that with a question mark. It's an indefinite state of existence. Okay, this is according to the Copenhagen interpretation. What's inside the box is not a definite state. Okay, so what? So now if Alice then looks inside the box, okay, then what she does is the very act of looking inside the box, what it does is, looking, okay, means shining a photon in there and looking at it and so on, and that photon interacts with what's inside that box, and in some mysterious way called the measurement problem that's not fully understood, it somehow forces nature to choose between this option or that option. It forces nature to change what is in Alice's box from an indefinite state of reality to something definite, either this or that. Okay? So she looks and forces nature to choose one or the other. Okay, and suppose that nature chooses this option, head, tail. I want you to notice here what happens. Suppose that nature chooses this option. What that means is this changes from an indefinite state to a definite state, head. But simultaneously, what happens in Bob's box is what was in there before was an indefinite state of reality. Okay, it instantaneously becomes a definite state. Okay, which is definitely a tails face. Okay, so I want you to understand that Alice is doing something here. Alice is on Mars, okay, and she's doing something in her box. She opens it up, looks inside, it changes from indefinite to heads, and then instantaneously, zero time to propagate here, the effect to propagate, what is in Bob's box changes from indefinite to definite, just the opposite, okay? So here we go. Changes happen simultaneously. This is action at a distance, okay? Heads, tails. Okay? And now, of course, what's in Bob's box is now definite. Okay? And so now when Bob opens the box and looks inside, he finds a tail. Okay? And or vice versa. Okay? So suppose that, you know, Alice looks inside the box and she forces in doing so, she forces nature to choose one of those two options. Suppose nature chooses option B here. Then what happens is this indefinite state, both of these indefinite states become definite simultaneously. Okay, this becomes a tail and that becomes a head. Okay? So her action over here has an influence on what's happening in Bob's box at a great distance, instantaneously. Okay, and then when Bob looks, he sees, yeah, that's heads. Okay, this is what Einstein referred to as spooky action at a distance. This was one of the things that Einstein had a lot of difficulty believing that this was actually happening, and so there's a long history to this, and you've heard some of this from your keynotes and so on. At the end of the day, the fact is that experiments were done by Alain Aspect and other people in the 1980s and continuing on to the present, more and more sophisticated experiments, which basically tell us that yeah, there is something weird like this going on. Now it depends a little bit upon your interpretation, but the idea that here's what is known to not be true. What is known to not be true is, so one way you might think about this is, yeah, okay, well, this is all silly. The dragon splits the faces of the coin and he puts one half in one box and the other half in the other box, and then sends them off to this great distance, and then Bob and Alice open the boxes, et cetera, right? And you might be thinking, yeah, okay, but what's in the boxes has been definite all along. Okay, all we actually see experimentally is Alice looks here and sees it. If Alice sees a tail, Bob sees a head, and vice versa. Well, that's just the obvious. Isn't it just obvious? That definiteness, tail head or head tail, existed even before the boxes were separated by this great distance, and there's nothing mysterious going on. The fact is, that has been shown to be false, okay, by experiment. We know that it's not, we know that that is not what's happening. There is something else happening, which has precisely this flavor of indefinite states or many worlds interpretation or all that kind of stuff. Okay? So, anyways, that's a little bit on entanglement here.